that kind of conversation between the soul. That's conversation between the soul and the mind.
Prestige heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade Derek Davison, and we're very excited to welcome to the podcast today Trita Parsi. Trita is the co-founder and executive vice president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, and he is the man with the plan when you want to know about Iran. But before we get into it, everyone, please, we've been doing a series of specials on the war in Iran. So please check that out at AmericanPrestigePod.com. Again, that's AmericanPrestigePod.com if you haven't yet. Trita, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. Great to be with you guys.
So obviously really grim times, and there's a lot to really talk about. But the first thing that I did want to ask you is, what do you think was going on in the administration? I know you have contacts in D.C., and what do you think led to this, what from many perspectives seems to be a very wild decision to go to war with Iran?
I think bottom line is that Trump was convinced that the Iranians were much weaker than they actually were. He was sold a story, a narrative by Netanyahu that, you know, this regime is about to fall. All you need to do is push it a little bit, threaten it a little bit, and eventually they'll fall. And you will be the amazing president that finally got rid of the Islamic Republic. That would be the most historic achievement you could possibly have. It would make the killing of Soleimani nothing, not even a footnote in comparison. And the Israelis played Trump's psychology very effectively, because those are the kinds of things that he is quite receptive to. He is not a person that in principle is against war, against regime change, or anything like that. He's in principle against things that are difficult and that are messy and that doesn't provide him with a quick glorified victory. So if you can then instead convince him that this is easy, this will be quick, you will be a hero, you will be historic, it won't take much effort, you just need to amass a bunch of aircraft carriers there and the Iranians will throw in the towel because they don't dare to have a fight, then you can convince him of that. And they did. And you could see how he gradually became more and more frustrated because the narrative didn't play out. And this is the fundamental error that he committed. He thought, based on this narrative, that the Iranians would really fear American aircraft carriers and war, and as a result, would surrender, not understanding that for this theocracy, they fear surrender far more than they fear war. And here we are.
Trita, in terms of how how we got here, the negotiations that were taking place between the U.S. and Iran in the weeks leading up to the decision to go to war, I want to ask you, based on what you know or what you've heard, how legitimate were those negotiations? Was the Trump administration really trying to get to a deal, or was this, again, as I suspect happened last year, like, to some degree, we're just stringing things out until we can pull the trigger on the war that we want?
So I have a little bit of a different view. I've seen a lot of folks say, hey, you know, this must have been just a ruse from the outset. I think Iranians probably think that. I think it's a little bit more complex. Not any more moral or dignified, but a little bit more complex.
Oh, definitely not those.
This was a legitimate negotiation from their end, but they were pursuing a completely unachievable objective. They thought that these negotiations are just to see when the Iranians are ready to capitulate. So every once in a while, they show up in Geneva or in Muscat, and they're like, well, are you ready to capitulate or not? The meeting prior to the last one lasted only 3 hours. And then they had to go on to their Ukraine meeting in the same city. That wasn't a serious negotiation. They were just checking in, telling them, did you see all the aircraft carriers, all the bombers that we moved to your border? Are you ready to give in now? And Witkoff even at one point admitted in an interview that Trump is frustrated as to why they haven't surrendered yet. That's what the diplomacy was about. It wasn't a ruse in order to, you know, secretly set in stage a path towards war. It was based on this completely false narrative that they're so weak they have no choice to capitulate. Now, we have an effort from the Israeli side to say that, oh, no, this was all planned months ago, already back in December 29th. This was all a deception. If I was in Israel, I would absolutely favor that narrative because it serves Israel's interests. Because that narrative completely destroys whatever little credibility American diplomacy has. And what has been a problem for the Israelis? The fact that every once in a while, not often, the United States wants to negotiate with one of Israel's enemies. And the Israelis have gone out of their way to try to prevent those negotiations from taking place in the first place or try to sabotage them. Well, if you can destroy America's diplomatic credibility, you don't have to worry about it because most negotiations won't take place anyways because no one's going to be foolish enough to negotiate with the United States. So I think they're pushing that narrative because it serves that purpose, but I don't think it is exactly what happened.
There was a piece that Laura Rosen wrote in her newsletter that I thought made a very good point, which is that the U.S. sent two people to negotiate this deal who have no background in anything related to nuclear issues, have no background really in international diplomacy. They're real estate guys. And so the last offer that the Iranians made, from what I've seen reported, which was, we will suspend enrichment for a period of several years. We won't stockpile any enriched uranium after that. That's a huge concession on the part of the Iranians. But her thought was Witkoff and Kushner just didn't understand the significance of it. They didn't understand that when they offered instead, their counteroffer was, well, the U.S. can just provide you with reactor fuel. Why do you need to enrich at all? The backdrop to that is Iran has been had the rug pulled out from under it on multiple occasions on deals like that. So why would they trust this administration above any other, above all others, to honor a commitment like that? So this is just maybe a question partly of having no experts on the negotiating team, nobody who understood Iran, nobody who understood the history here, just having these two real estate guys who were looking for the word zero enrichment on a page, or we capitulate, we surrender, as you say, and didn't get that. And so they call Trump and say, you know, they're not giving us what we want.
Yeah, no, I think Laura is quite correct, because we also saw that in the Ukraine scenario, that the Russians were actually frustrated with Witkoff because they believed he actually didn't understand what they were telling him and what they were proposing. And those negotiations, complex, certainly, but not technically complex. It has nothing to do about enrichment levels. And Witkoff still didn't manage to fully understand what the Russians were saying, and as a result, could not convey it appropriately or accurately to Trump. So I think that definitely is an element to it. And I think, again, if you already believe that the other side is so weak that they're just about to negotiate, you could have sent a three-year-old over to those negotiations because all they need to hear is, yes, I surrender. There's not a sentence more complex than that that you need to hear. But that all goes back to this false belief that they thought they're so weak, there's nothing else but this that they need to accept, and we just need to threaten and coerce them enough until they do so.
So we talked about the personalist element of Trump wanting to have glory to himself. We talked about the role that Israel played in wanting to destabilize Iran, which it essentially wants to do with most of the states in the region that it doesn't have a deal with. But there have been longstanding elements within the U.S. national security state that wanted to attack Iran. You know, famous John, bomb Iran a long time ago. So beyond the personalism and the Israel role, what might the elements within the U.S. state that wanted to do a regime change effort want out of this? Is it just to create chaos? Is it to affirm the Middle East as the United States' sphere of influence vis-a-vis rising China? I do think there are more geostrategic things going on here. I'm curious your thoughts about that.
I'm sympathetic to the view that oftentimes there are geopolitical considerations that go deeper than the ones that the politicians tend to put forward publicly, because those arguments or those reasonings are not necessarily easily understood by the government, by the public. But in this specific case, as I understand it, based on all the conversations I've had, the driving force inside the government has been Trump himself, and people around him actually being very skeptical about this. And then people in an outer circle, whether it is Lindsey Graham and others who are not formally in the administration, very aggressively pushing for it together with the Israelis. And what has happened in the administration is that Trump is increasingly listening to people outside the administration rather than people in his own administration. And we've seen a trend in this direction. There are people who were at the table in June. They did not succeed in stopping it back then. They're not even at the table this time around. They're not even in close to the conversations this time around. Whereas Lindsey Graham and Tom Cotton and Laura Loomer apparently is. And so I think you're seeing an aberration in terms of how this administration functions that makes it very difficult to fit it into previous models of how decisions are being made. On top of that, when it comes to the geopolitical considerations, it's very difficult for me to see how any of the people in this administration who wrote an NSS about the need for hemispheric dominance, although they didn't use that word, in any way, shape, or form would be able to motivate that this move, getting involved in another war in the Middle East, in any way, shape, or form, is conducive towards controlling the hemisphere. This seems to me to be completely the opposite. Or that this move puts the United States in a better position vis-a-vis the Russians and the Chinese. The Russians, for instance, are right now benefiting from the fact that the Iranian oil is not being sold. They're replacing it. Europeans are reaching an acute level of energy shortage, and they're now contemplating buying, guess what? Russian gas, which I'm sure is going to be really helpful to them in their struggle in favor of Ukraine. So I'm not really seeing this in any way, shape, or form playing out geopolitically in favor of the United States, even in a manner that someone inside the administration could motivate. And so as a result, I really do think that in this specific case, this is the vanity of Trump and the effectiveness of the Israelis to play to that vanity that has been the deciding factor to this. If you're an Elbridge Colby, I've not spoken to him, and you for a long time argued we got to get out of the Middle East and focus on China, how is this possibly working in his favor?
It reminds me almost of FDR, kind of a strange comparison, who would also ignore Cordell Hull and just refer to basically a series of advisors around him. The more personalist the president is, the less the state exerts a restraining influence. Derek, I know you've got a question.
Yeah, I mean, Trudy, what's really terrifying about this from the perspective of not knowing when or how this is going to end is that if Trump is the big driver, Trump has offered in the past 2.5 days about half a dozen at least different justifications for what he's trying to achieve. What do you make of this? Is it regime change? Is it regime collapse? Is it just the nuclear and missile files? Like, it's really been impossible to get a straight answer from anybody, Trump in particular, but you know, everybody else in the administration also seems to be all over the map in terms of what they're actually trying to achieve or what would be considered an end state, like a point at which you could push back and say, okay, we've accomplished our goals.
So I think we need to make a differentiation here. I think Trump does not like to spell out what his actual goals are, because if he does, he will be beholden to them and he will be compared to them. He likes to throw out a lot of confusing things. And then as things develop, he will then choose which one he pretends that he actually cared the most about in order to be able to make this a win. So I think there's an element of that that is deliberate. Where I think the confusing part is coming in is not what the goal is. It's the justification for the goal. That's when they are truly all over the place. I mean, they're grasping at straws. I mean, in his Truth Social speech, he said something along the lines that we had to do this because Iran was at war with civilization. I mean, I don't even understand that argument, but I also don't understand who in the MAGA crowd is going to be susceptible to that argument. So it seems like they're just desperately trying to find something to be able to justify the decision they've made, which is different from a confusion about the goal. I think the actual immediate goal was, and it's changed at this point, regime implosion. And they thought that the assassination of Ayatollah Khamenei would lead to that or pave the way to that. And I think they're deeply frustrated that it hasn't. I think they thought that they would have had this wrapped up by Sunday evening. And before the markets open on Sunday morning, it would have been a done deal and everything was fine. It's not worked out that way. So now I think we're in a situation in which the goals and objectives are going to be shifting, and they're going to be shifting in, at least in the initial stages, towards a much more aggressive posture. But the original goal, I think, actually was regime implosion, and they thought they had a shortcut. They thought, take out the supreme leader, the rest of it falls like a house of cards, which is a complete misread of that system. Not insignificant in any way, shape, or form that they killed the supreme leader, but the belief that that would cause the collapse of it is something completely different.
It really feels like he was expecting Maduro part two, essentially. Like, you take out one guy, somebody else steps in and says, okay, you know, uncle, we'll do whatever you want. And that's the end of it. Like, that then you can pack up. And he hasn't gotten that. And that's why I say, like, it just feels terrifyingly open-ended at this point, because it feels like they missed something that they were hoping to get. And now we're just on autopilot, not knowing, you know, what we're doing or why. And I guess my question would be, do you see a scenario in which this escalates to something that Trump and Pete Hegseth both refused to rule out just today? U.S. forces getting into Iran on the ground, which hitherto has seemed like the reddest of red lines for this administration. All of a sudden, in the last few hours, we've got these guys saying, well, you know, can't rule it out. You know, we'll do what we have to do. That seems very interesting to me.
I fear that is the most likely scenario we're going to be moving towards.
Because, wow.
Yeah.
Really? Oh, my God.
This is what I think is going to happen. First of all, forgive me, after being doing so many interviews, I don't even remember if I already said this in this interview or not.
You have not. No, Trita, we have an exclusive contract. What are you talking about?
Yeah, what do we mean, other interviews?
I wanted to just... The Iranian calculation is that they cannot accept a ceasefire until they have inflicted significant pain on the American side. They believe that if that is not done, the U.S. is just going to come back and bomb them again in another 6 months, which is exactly what happened last time. A lot of people in the IRGC were dead set against the ceasefire with Israel. They believe that they had turned a corner, that Israel was in a bad shape, and they should have continued the war. They didn't. And now the U.S. is back together with Israel with a much, much bigger hammer to slam them with. So they're not going to agree to a ceasefire until they believe the U.S. has suffered so badly that it will not go back into another war. That's the only way of making sure that the ceasefire is durable. If that is the Iranian calculation, that calculation is based on the belief that America or Trump's pain tolerance is relatively low. That if this drags out for another week or two, he's just not going to be able to continue to do it. This is part of the reason why he suddenly threw out 4 weeks. He threw out 4 weeks because he wanted to signal the Iranians that don't believe that I can't do this for 4 weeks. I can outlast you. And I think he said that after having failed to get them to agree to a ceasefire. At least two efforts were made through two different countries to get them to agree to a ceasefire. The Iranians rejected it. When Trump is saying that the Iranians asked for it, that is not what happened. Hegseth saying that they're not going to follow the old rules of the game, the rules around collateral damage, what he calls woke warfare. They're going to throw out all norms around the use of force, all kinds of international conventions on what they can and cannot do, and just go ballistic. This is their response to the Iranians trying to essentially force Trump to back down by saying, hey, we can outlast you. And he is saying, well, I can outbomb you. So we're going to go into a period in which both sides are going to dramatically increase the bombardment. I don't know to what extent the Iranians can go much further than they already have. Clearly, the U.S. can go much further than it already has. And we're going to see an extremely ugly period, extremely bloody period. Now, if that leads to the collapse of the regime and a regime implosion, perhaps it ends. If it doesn't, then we're going to go into a scenario in which we're going to go even further into the escalatory thing. And the next step for the U.S. at that point will be to bring in some ground troops, because the regime can survive bombardment and the population cannot overthrow it. They don't have the weaponry. They don't have force. They don't have the training, etc. At that point, the push is going to be, you got to bring in ground troops. You've gone so far. It's all going to be a sunk cost unless you go in and you turn it around. The fact that Tom Cotton started talking about or opening the door for ground troops already after 24 hours of this war, I think was quite noteworthy, because it made it very clear to me the neocons have a plan on how to get to that point. And slowly but surely, they're pushing Trump in that direction. He claims he doesn't want to go there. I don't believe he wants to go there. But if you don't want to go where the neocons want you to go, you should have said no from the very, very first ask that they had, instead of thinking that you can meet them halfway.
So, Treat, I know we only have you for a few more minutes. I want to get outside of D.C., outside of the U.S., and talk about, first, the region. The Iranians have made the decision to attack Gulf states. They started with U.S. bases, but they've expanded beyond that to pressure the Gulf states into pressuring the Trump administration to bring this to a quick end. What do you make of that decision? And do you think it's working? It seems to me like there may be some backfiring happening here from the Iranians' perspective in terms of just hardening the Gulf states against them. But I don't know.
Look, if the U.S. Navy had positioned itself within the range of Iranian missiles, I'm pretty confident the Iranians would have gone that route instead. But the U.S. actually positioned its ships in the Indian Ocean very far away from Iran, precisely because they knew that there is a likelihood that the Iranians have missiles that could be able to perhaps not sink the ships, but inflict significant damage. So the ships are there, but far enough away from Iran so Iran cannot hit them. So then the Iranians are going to go for the next available target, and that is U.S. bases in the region. Now, they went there very fast, faster than I thought that they would, and they went after all of them. You know, I thought perhaps they would go after Bahrain first and perhaps escalate slowly. They've gone full on right away. The only country that wasn't bombing the first day was Oman, but even Oman has been struck at this point, it appears. And that is, again, because they are trying to inflict as much damage as possible on the U.S., on the oil markets, on global inflation rates, on U.S. inflation rates. They think, again, this cannot end until everyone thinks it's too costly for it to continue and too costly for it to restart. Now, again, that means that they're running a huge risk that this will backfire. And the backfiring is not just what would happen in U.S.-Saudi or U.S.-GCC, it's our Iran-GCC relations after the war. I don't think the Iranians even seem to care that much about that at this point, frankly. The backfiring is if it actually brings the Saudis or others into the war. And there, it seems like the Iranians are kind of nonchalant about it. Perhaps they're okay with it. And, you know, what assets could the Saudis really bring into it? And if the Emiratis step in, I mean, the Iranians could definitely intensify the bombardment of Dubai and Abu Dhabi. And, you know, the idea of this being some sort of an island of stability will be forever destroyed. So I don't think they're too worried about that escalation. And I personally don't think the Saudis will step in until the Iranians either are so weakened that it's low risk for them and they're just doing it to show that they did strike back, or a scenario of that kind. But other than that, I at this point, I find it unlikely that the Saudis would want to go in, because the bottom line is the whole thing was supposed to be that they would not be dragged into this war. And, you know, is it better for them to tolerate a couple of strikes or should they go all out? The Iranians go all out because they find this to be existential. Does the Saudis think this is existential? I don't think they do. So I don't think that will happen. But you're also seeing, nevertheless, I think there's going to be a devastation in the GCC-Iran relations for some time after this. But you're also seeing the other thing happening, which is the Emiratis and the Qataris are actually working together to try to build a coalition of states to convince Trump to take an off-ramp. So the thing the Iranians wanted to see also seems to be happening. So I think the Iranians made a calculation that both of these things will happen, but it's worth the risk to them because this is an existential fight.
So Trita, just final question before you go. It'll be an easy one to answer. What can we expect for Iranian society post-Khamenei? What does it seem to be shaping up here in the region? The regime seems stable, doesn't seem like it's going to be overthrown. Is there anything you could tell us about that?
I mean, this is devastating the Iranian society. After decades of sanctions, we've seen already that the Iranian society has become so much less powerful, so much weaker vis-a-vis the state, that what you saw in the protests last month was that people went out to the streets protesting from a position of desperation. If the JCPOA had remained in place, if Trump had not walked out of it, and the economic growth of Iran had continued and the middle class had strengthened instead of what happened when Trump imposed maximum pressure sanctions, one-third of Iran's middle class went into poverty as a result of those sanctions. In that other scenario, in that other reality in which the JCPOA would have remained in place and the economy would have grown, I think you would have seen protest again. But this time around, society would be asserting itself on the state from a position of strength rather than from a position of desperation. Now we're going even further in the direction of desperation. And I do fear that the risk of civil war is actually very significant.
Trita, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. Everyone, check out the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, their podcast, Always at War, and Responsible Statecraft, their publication. Trita, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Hello, everyone. Again, we hope you enjoyed that interview with Trita Parsi. We are now speaking with Akbar Shahid Ahmed, who's a senior diplomatic correspondent at the Huffington Post. We've had him on before, and we're happy to have him on again. Akbar, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So one of the things that we haven't talked about yet in our discussions about Iran are the rules of engagement that the United States seems to be pursuing. The United States is now war fighting. And it is going to, in theory, abide by certain rules. So
I don't know about that, Danny. We're not doing a woke war. This is different from the woke wars of the past.
Oh, I'm sorry. Woke is broke. Okay, yeah, so we're just killing everyone and everything.
We're not doing woke anymore.
Akbar, so what have you heard about the rules of engagement? What should people be aware of here?
So here's what I'm hearing. It's really important to remember that brutal as U.S. wars have been, especially in this post-9/11 period, the U.S. has tried to make commitments to kill fewer civilians, kill fewer schoolchildren, and not, you know, produce this broad societal blowback. Right now, we're seeing a convergence of kind of three factors that are really worrying. One is the U.S. is in bed with the IDF in this operation in a way that it has not been ever, right, to the extent of joint, huge military operation. And the IDF, obviously, in the Gaza war in the last several years has shown us their view of the rules of engagement is a lot more, as one very well-connected U.S. person just put it to me 20 minutes ago, was lethally permissive, right? I mean, they are, the Israelis look at this and they're not thinking the same way that U.S. military officials will. Then there's the tone set from the top of the Trump administration. I mean, President Trump has, of course, salivated over the prospect of violence abroad consistently throughout his political career. And you saw Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth today say, rules of engagement, we don't really know if they apply in this context. I mean, sort of continuing his woke is broke narrative. And the third is just a broader, and I'm sure you got into this with Trita, the broader dehumanization of Iran and Iranians, I mean, from an American standpoint, of this idea that this is this huge enemy, this is an acceptable population to deal with through just blunt force. And I think countering all of that would be really, really hard in any scenario. Under a Trump administration, I'm very worried about kind of a really bloody outcome.
Derek, I know you have a comment, but I just want to do a brief, just very quick historical thing, because I think a few years ago, Sam Moyn, friend of the pod, actually released a book called The Case Against Humane War. And I just want to underline this because I think this is a departure from what we've seen, particularly in the post-Cold War period, which was this idea that war was becoming increasingly humane. With the first Gulf War of the early 90s, you had this revolution in military affairs. And the revolution in military affairs was essentially the idea that you would use information and precision technology like GPS, which was really first deployed in that war, to make wars less lethal and less deadly. And I think you saw that argument that war was going to become humane really increase over the course of the 1990s and 2000s and even into the 2010s. The idea was that you would use, like under Obama, drone strikes, or even under the first Iraq War, you would have such good a second Iraq war under Bush, George W. Bush, you would have enough information that you would be able to prosecute this war quickly. And so I just want to underline this, that this is really a departure, almost a return to pre-legal code war, pre-Geneva Convention war, which are a series of things that happened over the 19th and 20th centuries, where you're just going to stop caring about any sorts of rules of engagement. And this really is a departure. And I do think it has to do with the dehumanization that the United States has had vis-a-vis Iran since the 79-80 revolution. So I just wanted to put it in a bit of context. Sorry, Derek, off to you.
Well, I mean, so the dehumanization is par for the course for the U.S. I mean, not maybe this overtly, but you know, we don't humanize the other. We never do. But I'm sort of curious. There's a couple of things I'm curious about here. When Hegseth says he's not sure that the rules of engagement apply, why wouldn't they apply? Like, what would be the formal reason why they wouldn't apply? Like, during, you know, in the war on terror, when, you know, the invasion of Iraq or the war in Afghanistan, the argument was, well, these aren't really lawful combatants. Like they're not, they don't belong to a nation state. Like we're fighting terrorists. And so, you know, the rules don't apply and we can throw them in a pit like Abu Ghraib and do whatever we want to them. We don't have to treat them like prisoners of war. We don't have to abide by any of the rules of armed conflict. We can just do what we want. In this case, that claim, I mean, you can't make that claim. That's absurd. So is there an official explanation for this, or is it just like we don't care about that kind of stuff anymore?
There's not a lot of official justification. What you have seen from the start of the Trump administration is that they targeted what the military had was called a center of excellence. And I understand for many people looking at the US military, the idea of a center of excellence on shielding civilians may be a hard pill to swallow. But I think there were real good faith efforts by people to do that. Some from whatever motivation, some from the sense of we don't want our soldiers charged with war crimes. What you've seen from the Trump administration is the unstated assumption that we don't have to do this because we are America and we're tougher and we're stronger. I mean, that's really the argument. It's just, what are you going to do to us? And so it is kind of the end point in so many ways of trends through the war on terror of American exceptionalism and a lack of accountability. But I do think that's a lot of bluster, right? If anything, the interest and the sense that the Trump administration is on a different course from all its allies on international law is really great. And I think a lot of allies are thinking, how do we get back to those principles?
So that's a whole nother line of discussion that we need to get into. But my second question coming out of Tipsy McStagger's speech today is when you say that, on the one hand, this is a war, as Trump did when he launched it, this is a war to liberate the Iranian people. The Iranian people need to rise up and overthrow their government. We're giving you the opportunity to rise up and overthrow this, you know, government that's oppressing you and, you know, claim your country and claim your freedom. And, you know, you've had other people in the administration say this is not a war on Iran. It's a war on the Islamic Republic. It's a war on the regime. You know, it's not, you know, it's nothing more than that. But then you turn around and you have the Secretary of Defense say, we're going to kill everybody. We don't really care. Like, we'll just kill whoever's there and, you know, figure it out later. Like, how do you square those two things up? How do you tell the Iranian people, go out in the streets and take your country back, but also we're going to kill you probably because we don't give a shit who we hit?
Some of the messages I've heard from folks in the Iranian opposition universe are illuminating in this regard, right? So some people are so anti-regime that the argument is literally, I will maybe see myself as a sacrifice, and if I have to die on our way to liberation, then that's where we're going. That is an argument that's a genuine argument from some people, and it speaks to the degree of deprivation and repression people have felt and hopelessness.
These are people inside Iran, so these are people
not
diaspora, because I've seen the diaspora be like, yeah, those kids at the school had it coming because they were next to a military base, which, you know, is monstrous, but right. if these are people inside Iran, I get that.
Right. I mean, that's the, you know, whose voice is really relevant here. And but then, as you see, it's this question of, especially today, I think that's also what's so interesting about the way this has evolved over literally just 2.5 days. We've had days of up to 1,000 strikes, right? So you are going to be hitting civilian targets and you're hitting now crowded streets and squares and apartment buildings. So the initial claim, any sort of halo that there was, even the halo of you have killed this reviled supreme leader, that's faded very quickly. I mean, I think today is the day of the turning point for a lot of Iranians that I've heard from.
One thing this does indicate to me, and sorry, I'm going to get a bit big brain for everyone, is the decline of American hegemony as a consensual project. And I think this is yet another nail in the coffin of the American century, because I think one of the things that the American century did was that the United States would do things like make war humane, that, you know, you would have Koreas and you would have Vietnams, but overall the world would not have a World War I or let alone a World War II. And the fact that you have such a high official like the Secretary of Defense just saying, we don't give a shit. Like, Derek, like, you're totally right. We've always othered people. These were racialized wars. The global war on terror was clearly a racialized war to some degree. It was still at least in theory, promoted in terms of liberal universalist ideals of bringing democracy. Now, whether that's bullshit or not, I think some people thought that was bullshit. I think some people believed in that. I think it's different according to who you're talking about in the administration. But there was this type of universalistic rhetoric. The fact that we're not getting this sold to the American public in any way, the fact that we no longer care about the rules of engagement does indicate a general transition, I believe, in the larger macro structure of international relations, where the United States is no longer presenting itself as the liberal universalist ideal upon which history is rests, capital H history. And this is really an example of that. So I think that this war is really going to be a turning point, not only in the history of U.S. foreign relations, in the history of the Middle East, but in how the United States conceives of itself at a global stage. Because even if you get like a President Buttigieg, or even if you get a President Vance in 2028, I think that the United States has now explicitly revealed itself as something that is different from what it claimed to be in the past. And this does seem to me like an actual hinge point beyond the specific effects of the war.
I think, Akbar, sorry, just to comment on that, like it's stunning, really, for a president who runs on America first and, you know, harkens back to people like Reagan for a party that still, you know, hangs itself on Reagan's legacy. We've gone from America's the shining city on the hill to we're just like another nation, like we're just any other nation. We just kill who we want to kill. We're more powerful than the rest of them, and we use that in whatever ways that we want. It's a pettiness that was always there. Like the, you know, shining city on the hill thing was always bullshit, but to just be open about it now is definitely a come down from where we used to put ourselves in terms of national image.
And I think the salience and the power of that message, and I'll say this just personally as an immigrant, who's someone who came to this country and like signed up to the project and with a belief in a lot of those principles being able to be part of it. What I see from so many friends is this is also the hinge point coming at a moment when the walls have been put up on the American project. So it's not even, is it an attractive and appealing project you might want to join? Even if you want to join it, your ability to join it has now been shrunk down to blood and soil again in a way it hadn't been for decades, right? So if you are someone observing this from Asia, from Africa, you have seen messages from the administration saying effectively what we want is a specific kind of immigration and it's not you. And so I think that really affects the global image factor now. And this idea, I mean, I have talked to so many U.S. officials about Gaza and how they dealt with the image impact of that, of being seen as implicated in a genocide. And often they would say things like, well, people got over the Iraq War. People always want to be America's friend. This is, you did the Iraq War, then you did all the various other things, and now you're asking people to get over another excess. It's just that much harder.
Another one that was also unprovoked. I mean, the very existence of a ballistic missile program or a nuclear enrichment program, I don't think many people would view as a genuine provocation. And say what you will about Saddam Hussein, but there were prisms through which one could view Iraq and WMD as I don't know, something. But this one is just really so egregious and so in hoc to another nation's interests. And it was interesting to me because I saw people talking online about, you know, comparing this to Hitler and Mussolini. But, you know, if you look at Hitler, Hitler was trying to have Lebensraum with his wars in the East. And Mussolini, by attacking Ethiopia, was trying to participate in sort of the European imperial game, which France and Britain were participating in. This one is just... it's almost absent of geostrategic logic. I mean, obviously we don't support fascist wars on this podcast for Lebensraum or for imperialism, but like there was a geostrategic logic that was at a macro level here. Here it's just so strange. It is just literally you have the power, so you use it. And it is, I think that is more difficult to overcome in the future because there is no logic behind it. There's nothing to forget about. And that does seem to make this attack unique in the history of U.S. foreign relations.
It's hard to swallow too when you are watching a president who his first update on Iran broke off within 7 minutes to, and look at these drapes behind me. right? I mean, it gives the sense right, of...
Yeah. Like Melania hates these or whatever. Yeah, it was just surreal.
It just gives a sense of it's cartoonish. I mean, it's cartoonish to watch, but it's also just so so disconnected from the reality that not only are more than 500 Iranians dead, probably dozens more, I thought, you know, also people's lives have been disrupted to a huge degree all over the region. And the amount of fear of fragmentation of an Iran, of the Gulf, of Pakistan, of Afghanistan is tremendous.
The other thing that I've noticed, and this isn't a question, I have a question about Europe actually, but the other thing I've noticed along these lines is all the social media accounts of the military commands are doing this, but CENTCOM has obviously been the one doing it right now, putting out these just war porn clip videos of shit that they're blowing up. And it's just so undignified. Like, you're killing people. Have some gravitas about it, for fuck's sake. Like, have some sense of the moment. But instead, they're just like, yeah, fuck, look at this explosion. Hell yeah. Motherfucker. Like, it's just so embarrassing to watch. And I don't know who the audience, I mean, it's the jugheads, I guess, the hooting, you know, the hooters for MAGA, the ones who haven't, you know, kind of started to question what they're doing because of all of this. But man, like, it just looks awful. It is a terribly embarrassing way to present yourself in a situation like this. So, Akbar, I wanted to ask you, you wrote a piece for HuffPost. Trump says he brought justice to Iran. His war boost fears the U.S. has gone rogue, which is about how this is going to play long term in terms of the U.S. image around the world. And I feel like we need to contrast whatever concerns European leaders or U.S. allies might have about whether or not the United States is full blown rogue state, which are legitimate, and I don't have any doubt that they have them. Certainly, the freak out over Greenland probably reinforced some things. But in this case, contrasting that with the statements that we've seen these governments make, which have been absolutely absurd in some cases, like the statement I've said this, you know, I've mentioned this in a couple of our updates to Danny. The statement that the UK, France, and Germany put out on Saturday demanding that Iran stop attacking places in the Middle East and come back to the negotiating table, which they were at before the US started bombing them, was just surreal. It's like, what conflict are you talking about? And you've had Mark Carney, who's, you know, off of this big Davos speech where he's talking about, we can't rely on the US anymore. And I didn't say that, but in so many words, like, the middle powers have to band together and do what's right for us. Just falling in line, like, everybody's falling in line behind this. And so how do you sort of assess that, like, the in the moment? And of course it's Iran, so nobody cares really, like, blow up Iran, it doesn't matter to us, it's, you know, fine. But still, like, the falling in line behind what is a flagrantly illegal violation of the UN Charter, violation of international law, even at a time when they're supposedly concerned about the US kind of turning rogue.
Right, and supposedly saying we need to re-energize those principles, we need European sovereignty behind our values, and Carney, of course, saying middle powers need to band together behind all this. I think it's there's an interesting parallel there to sort of the way that Israel and its enemies have been dealing with each other, by which I mean Israel has in some ways been able to pick off its enemies one by one. They haven't been able to question it in the region. That's sort of a trend we've been seeing. Similarly, I think some folks looking at the US, Israel is trying to become a regional hegemon. The US is trying to say we are reshaping global politics through muscle. And I think countries are saying, if we can singularly appease you, you won't invade Canada, or you won't take Greenland, or we'll be the exception. And I think who can say how that gamble will play out, but it's a very risky gamble. And certainly there are people in all of those societies who feel you're only inviting more violations of the UN Charter. I mean, Canadians, I think, are looking at this and thinking, oh, our sovereignty actually is maybe in question. I think the other question is looking at the US system and realizing how few restraints there are. I mean, so much of the reporting has been, of course, rightfully so, on Netanyahu and potentially the Saudis, who's been encouraging Trump externally to do this. But a lot of my reporting in the run-up to this, and the unbelievable consensus I kept getting was no one is willing to say no to Trump for their own craven, careerist, whatever reasons, or ideological, they love the policy, whatever it is. But there's just not that kind of voice of reason in the system. And I think that's scary to people. You see that with the boat strikes in the Pacific. I mean, where down the line, even Chairman Keane of the Chiefs of Staff, who's seen as relatively more cautious, certainly was more cautious on Iran, giving some warnings, fell in line on the boat strikes. I mean, has basically said, you can attack shipwrecked people, and I'm going to essentially tell uniformed troops that this quite clear violation of international law is A-OK procedure. That messaging, I think, is really hard to take back, because then you're looking at people who are meant to be nonpartisan, people who last across administrations, and it looks a lot more like systemic failure.
I mean, Keane is an interesting case. As you said, he was, you know, kind of cautiously, at least the reporting suggested, suggesting to Trump that, you know, this might not be the best idea. We don't have, you know, a lot of munitions. We've been depleted, especially air defenses. So maybe it's not the greatest idea to get into an extended war with Iran right now. But when push came to shove, there was no real pushback. It was, you know, just kind of cautiously suggesting this and then falling in line, as you say. And I wonder, in some of these cases, I mean, obviously you have ideologues who support this down the line, like have wanted to go to war with Iran for, you know, or their, you know, kin in that, in the foreign policy community have wanted to go to war with Iran for 47 years. You also have the people who are just craven enough to do whatever Trump says to stand his good side. Is there still any sense, this was big in the first term, obviously, especially among the generals that Trump surrounded himself with. Is there still any sense of like being the adult in the room and maybe you have to massage your comments to in a certain way because you need to stay there because Trump left unchecked by the quote unquote adults could go hog wild. And Dan, you know, somebody like Dan Keane may see it as more important that he stays in the room and doesn't alienate Trump than that he actually stands up on any principle related to this.
The name I hear most often referenced as effectively the adult in the room or the moderating factor is Susie Wiles, the chief of staff, right? And that's...
who's not foreign policy person, so that's great.
Right, yeah, it's like out of Florida politics, right? So that gives you a sense of where that trust is coming from. Maybe to an extent, people will sometimes say, oh, Vance will rein in some interventionist instincts, but that to me, that seems both designed to give Vance a pass for his future political careers and be totally ineffective. I mean, if that, so it's irrelevant. But I haven't heard any, like even right now, if I'm thinking about sort of how does Trump find his way out of this in that appearance where he talked about the drapes, he said, I'm not getting bored, but he seemed kind of bored. You know, I don't think he wants to be seeing this for a long time. He wants to talk about the ballroom. But I genuinely don't know who in the inner circle could offer some incredible negotiation strategy. It's certainly not, you know, Jared Kushner and Steve Witkoff. They've been faces who people like dealing with. There is a genuine camaraderie to some extent there with some of the interlocutors. But the technical details of any agreement have eluded them, clearly. And the ability to overcome the interventionist camp is not there either.
I mean, this is the truth of the matter is the president can do what they want. That is a big problem with the presidency itself. It's something that left-wing critics have been saying for decades. And the big issue is that this is not something that is even broached in American politics. It's not even taboo because people don't even think it through. And I just don't see, this is why you know, you could never trust the military structure itself because the president effectively is the genuine commander-in-chief, essentially does have authority to do whatever they want. The Supreme Court says they literally cannot commit a crime if they are enacting something in the service of their job. So we've essentially created a divine king. It's just that the divine king is replaced every 4 or 8 years. That is a gigantic structural issue that whenever anyone becomes president, they don't fix. So you would need the type of person who doesn't become president to become president for this to change. So it makes me very nihilistic about any opportunity for this to actually transform. I just don't see how it practically would unless Congress becomes a totally different institution, which it doesn't seem like is exactly in the offing. They can't even pass legislation to restrict the power of the president.
But I think this is where, you know, we're going to see two war powers votes in Congress imminently, and Democrats are talking that up as this is us restraining Trump and we're using all these things. But the war powers resolution has never effectively been used because presidents can veto it and you can never get a two-thirds majority. We haven't seen that. And, you know, the argument, I was on a call with Senator Kaine yesterday, who's a supporter of, who's the proponent of this resolution, is, well, even if it doesn't pass, we can shame the president. But it gets to your point, Annie, because then you're then counting on the personality of the president.
How are you going to shame Donald Trump?
What are you talking about? It's ridiculous.
That's the argument is...
I hope someone on that call was like, what the fuck are you talking? That is political malpractice. I mean, it's unserious. You know, it is like the succession line. It is, you are unserious people. And that's what that indicates to me. It is fundamentally unserious and that it is someone who has accepted that they're going to have no power. It's absurd.
It certainly accepts the structure in which we're never going to pass the war powers resolution, and this is effectively just a signaling mechanism. But that is a choice made not just by President Trump and his cabinet. It's made bipartisan by hundreds of people with a lot of effective power they could be using.
What have you made, I guess, maybe we could talk a little bit more about this, of the response from the Democratic Party. I actually saw, and this is like a deep cut. I haven't seen one of these in a while, but I actually saw a Democrats in disarray headline earlier today. I think it might have been in The Guardian, but, you know, Democrats in disarray over this because some of them support what Trump is doing. Some of them support it but don't want to say so out loud, so they latch on to this procedural argument that, you know, you just haven't followed the rules of going to war and how dare you. And then you've got the genuine anti-war voices. These are not things that can coexist in a single party, it doesn't feel like.
Well, it also speaks to the failure to reckon with the Biden legacy, right? It speaks to the inability and the real unwillingness, and I've written a whole book about Biden's foreign policy that will be out in September that you can read, and hopefully some of these Democrats will, but it's very hard for Democrats to come out with their whole chest and say, we oppose this illegal, inhumane policy when Biden administration officials have praised Trump's Iran policy consistently since it's been out and have said, actually, this is a continuation of us helping Israel put pressure on Iran and its network. Right. So some Democrats are really still finding out a persuasive argument. We know that Jake Sullivan, who was Biden's national security advisor, is in close contact with many senior lawmakers on a frequent basis. So we know that there's it's not just about where do we go forward. It's also, can we reckon with our role in getting to this point of high tension and a sense of impunity and a sense of regional stability is not the focus. It's more how hard can we punch? And that was a Biden-era logic.
So, Akbar, I don't want to draw this out because this is going to keep going. This is my question. But there's going to be a lot more to talk about as this goes on. How do you see this playing out based on the conversations that you're having? You know, again, this is something where Trump has been all over the map. He's going to offer them, you know, he's going to offer a negotiations, or he's not, or this is going to go on as long as it takes, or it's going to be over in 2 days, or now it's going to be over in 5 weeks, but we could go longer, or 6 weeks, according to Tipsy McStagger. Like, anything is on the table here. It seems like there's no end game. There's no end scenario that they're imagining. It's just going to go until it peters itself out, I guess. There is the element of the Gulf states maybe pressuring the administration to get to a ceasefire because they're tired of Iranian drones hitting their cities and their ports. But I don't know what the path out of this is. And I'm curious if what you've heard and what your sense is, if there is one, or if we're just sort of on autopilot now.
Certainly the path to a negotiated settlement to all the objectives that Trump laid out today, if we take him at his word, which is nuclear missiles, regional influence, and you know the evilness of the regime, I guess. That's on the Iranian side, they're not going to negotiate some kind of settlement with him. I mean, we've seen them escalate every single day since this has begun. And in the shadow of Khamenei's killing, I think it's very hard to reach a compromise on the Iranian side. Also, we still don't know. These Iranian attacks appear to be directed by dispersed military commands rather than coming from the top, right? And so it's harder to get everyone in line. But I do think that the Gulf route is probably the most likely in that Trump has taken Gulf interlocutors seriously in the past. He obviously has massive financial investments there. So I think an argument from the Qataris, the Emiratis, Bahrainis to some extent, Saudis certainly, that we just can't afford this, you don't want to see a global recession, that'll be the most persuasive argument. But it will take a lot of reining in Trump and a lot of reining in Trump promises. And I think that, you know, people do think that he has this ability to defy gravity. I don't know, a lot of the Iran hawks, this is their dream moment. As you mentioned, after 50 years, they're not going to take it lying down if he suddenly says, oh, I'm okay just ending this as a decapitation strike war and some bombing. So I'll be watching the Gulf. That's my main focus.
Akbar, thank you so much for joining us. We really, really appreciate it. And of course, look forward to having you back again soon to talk about more depressing war news.
Thanks a lot, guys.
You know that wellness goal you set at the start of the year? It's not too late to stick with it and make your future self proud, especially with the all-in-one nutrition shake from Ka'Chava. With 25 grams of protein, 6 grams of fiber, greens, adaptogens, and more. No fillers, no nonsense, just the highest quality ingredients. Stick with your wellness goals. Go to Ka'Chava.com and use code NEWS for 15% off. That's Ka'Chava.com, code NEWS.